Good morning, and welcome to another in our series of mini shiurim on the Book of Esther. We're learning in the merit of the IDF, Israel's emergency services, the hostages, and the injured. And we are at the start of Perek Gimel, Chapter 3. There's much more we could have said on Chapter 2, but we should move along a little bit. So Chapter 3 opens with the elevation of Haman, achar hadivorim ha'ele, after these events from Chapter 2. We'll talk a little bit more about that bridge in a bit. Gidal Hamelach Achashverosh as Haman ben Hamadasa, etc. So King Achashverosh elevated Haman, son of Hamadasa, and so on. And we know that he is put in charge of Kol Hasarim Asherito. He is in charge of all of the nobles. And not only that, but everybody at the palace gate bows to Haman, and so on. So my opening question is, who held this position before Haman? Right? Like, who was Haman replacing? My second question, what was Haman's position before this? Who was Haman until now? And third, why give Haman so much power? He really makes him second in command in the entire massive empire. So going back to the first question of who is Haman's predecessor, there does not seem to be a predecessor. There's no mention of somebody who gets executed a la Vashti. There's no mention at all of who was before him. We saw that there were councils. There were the seven, the seven Chachamim Yodei Ha'itim, the wise men who know times. We know that there were the servants in the court, but we had no reference point at all for anybody in this position of second in command beforehand. I would have thought we would have seen him in the discussion about Vashti, for example, but nothing. So it sounds like this is a brand new position. To which then you have to ask, so why create a brand new position? So three theories. Two we'll do now, and the third we're going to have to come back to. The first theory, which would have been my own thought, is remember that Chapter 2 ended with the assassination attempt on Achashverosh by Bigtan and Teresh. So maybe now Achashverosh is looking for somebody who is loyal to him, who he's going to give a lot of power to, and that person is going to be in charge, and that's Haman. Professor Chazoni, who I've quoted before from his book, The Dawn, sharpens this idea. He says the following on page 45. Like Vashti's insubordination, the treachery of his trusted officers, meaning Bigtan and Teresh, leaves Achashverosh exposed before the kingdom and in his own eyes. While he presumes to possess the power to rule the known world, it becomes apparent that he cannot even tell what is happening in the palace at Susa. And just as Vashti's rebellion leads him to reassert himself by deposing and banishing her, executing whatever he's doing, so too does the rebellion of the king's servants lead him to take drastic action to grind them all under his heel. He responds to the chaos with the imposition of a figure he believes will be able to restore order, and whom he intends to inspire awe in other would-be conspirators. Haman the Agagite, before whom Achashverosh decrees the entire political leadership of the empire is expected to pay obeisance, right? His read is that Haman is in fact in charge of everybody. It's not just those at the gate who have to bow to Haman. It's everyone everywhere. And it's an attempt to tame the intrigues that are going on or that Achashverosh is afraid are going on. So that's one approach. This is a brand new position meant to bring everybody in line and intimidate everybody. And that's, I think, a good approach. Second approach, you might suggest, would come from a story in Daniel Perek Vav. Remember that, and we referenced it the other day. Chapter 5 of Sefer Daniel is the end of the Babylonian Empire, the big party of King Belshazzar, the hand emerges and writes on the wall, and so on. That night, as we're told at the end of Chapter 5, the Babylonians are defeated by the Persians and Medes. And then Chapter 6, the Medes are in charge. Daryavesh Hamadi, Darius the Mede. And as I've said before, it's very unclear who this King Darius the Mede was. Nonetheless, he is the king, and he is described as rising to the throne at what would seem to be a fairly advanced age for the way things worked then. Today, in the U.S., we have, an octogenarian president coming next, whichever way you slice it. So a little bit of a different story in our day. But Daryavesh is 62 years old when he takes the throne. And that's Daniel Perek Vav, Daniel chapter 6. And what he does is he creates two layers of government. He has three main governors, and below them he has 120 agents who report to those three governors. So whether they're in charge of districts, how exactly it works, is a good discussion to have. But the point is, he has two layers of government below him. And then his advisors change the story. And his advisors say to him, we think there should be a 30-day period in which anybody who wants anything throughout your entire kingdom would have to come to you directly. Anybody who does not come to you is going to be punished. That's the and punished means executed. That's what the advisors of Darius say to him. Now, in Sefer Daniel, the way that this is presented is that it's a plot. It's in order to bring down Daniel, because they know, and the text tells us this explicitly, that Daniel every day davens three times a day by his window towards Yerushalayim. This is our earliest known biblical source for that idea of davening three times a day and of davening towards Yerushalayim. So they know that he does it, and so they figure he's going to pray to his God instead of coming to ask Darius for the things that he needs, and we're going to get him thrown to the lions, which in fact is what happens, and then, of course, he survives it. But the point is, they pitch it to Darius not as, hey, we're going to get Daniel. They pitch it to Darius as a way to cement his authority. So we're going to make sure that everybody has to report to you. That's what they do there. So everyone is going to have to interface with you. And what I'm seeing Ahasuerus do here is the opposite. Ahasuerus is withdrawing in fear after the assassination attempt. This way, nobody has access to Ahasuerus. Everybody has to work through Haman, right? Darius wants to say, everybody work through me. Ahasuerus says, everybody work through Haman. That explains something that we find later on in the Megillah. Remember how Esther can't go to Ahasuerus because nobody comes to the king uninvited. If they do, they get killed, right? How do you run an empire that way? Nobody comes to the king uninvited. Nobody gets to talk to the king. Nobody gets to tell the king about stuff that's going on. You always have to work through intermediaries. That's a terrible way to run your government. But that's exactly how you run your government if you are in fear. So Ahasuerus is essentially withdrawing into hiding. Haman becomes the external projection of Ahasuerus's power. I think that's a legitimate second way to read it. I have seen some suggest that this is written up in Rabbi Yeshua Bachrach's Kizvuni Ledoros, which is somewhere in my house, I think. But I don't remember where it is at the moment, and things are a little bit turbulent in terms of access to Sfarim at the moment due to some work. So I can't look it up and check, but I have in my notes that I did see somebody reference Kisvuni Ledoros with this idea. So that's a second idea. So either this is Ahasuerus putting in place somebody who's going to be really loyal to him with a lot of power to tame the intrigues of the court, or alternatively, this is somebody who will enable Ahasuerus to hide from the world. You take care of it. You be in charge. I don't want to see anybody. I don't want anybody coming to me lest they attack me. The opposite of Darius saying, hey, 30-day period in which everybody has to talk to me. So we're going to see a third approach, which is going to come from Malbim a little bit later, which is going to take an entirely different read and say that actually this is meant to appease Esther. Of all people, the elevation of Haman is meant to appease Esther. So we're going to have to talk about that. But where I want to go next, now that we have these different theories for why Ahasuerus would create a brand new position with Haman, is to ask, so why Haman? How did you pick Haman to be the one to play this role? And we're going to see two different approaches. Approach number one, it's a rags-to-riches story for Haman. Approach number two is that it's churn within the court. Two different ways that you could actually read this. We're going to start on it, and then we'll continue it, I think, tomorrow. But the first approach is that this is, as I said, rags to riches. And that is a Gemara in Megillah, Daf Tezayin Amud Aleph, it may be familiar, which says, Tana Haman Sapar Shakvar Kartzum Haya Esrim Ushtayim Shana. Haman was the barber of a place called Kfar Kartzum for 22 years before being elevated. We also have another medrash that says that he was Mordechai's Eved, he was Mordechai's servant. Where do you get this from? Why would you say this? So, first of all, just from the text itself, the fact that in chapter 6, Haman ends up being Mordechai's Eved, he becomes Mordechai's, not his Eved, his valet, to prepare Mordechai, right? If he's just, you know, a diplomat who's been in power all along, it's a little bit of an odd thing to do. However, it makes sense if he's actually, if he has a history doing this sort of thing. I think you also see two messages that emerge from saying Haman was the barber. Message number one is to insult him, right? We're degrading him by saying, oh, he was the barber. No offense to barbers. But that would have been the way he was looked at in that milieu. And number two, to highlight that everything is from Hashem. Major theme in Tanakh. Hashem elevates the lowly. He brings down the great. Look at that. Hashem orchestrated this, that Haman will now will rise from being a barber to a position of power. How would this explain the fact that chapter 3 begins with Achar ha-devarim ha'ela, after these things that were happened before, now Achashverosh elevated Haman? So I think it fits very, really well if Haman is elevating someone who is lowly, if Achashverosh is elevating someone who is lowly. Haman is somebody of no standing. He's the local barber. Now he gets the position, not local, he's in Kfar Kartzum, but you know what I mean. He gets this position, why? Because Achashverosh is afraid after the assassination attempt. So Achashverosh chooses somebody who's a nobody. He chooses someone who's going to depend on him. Like we said, explains why he chooses Esther, who has no nationality to tout, making it sound like she's a nobody from nowhere. So we gave different explanations for why she does that. But one approach is that she's positioning herself as a nobody, and that makes Achashverosh choose her because he is in fear. He doesn't want somebody with a lot of power, with a lot of aristocratic background. So too, he picks Haman out of nowhere. Now you're going to depend on me. You have no standing of your own. You're in power because I gave you power, and that's it. So that's actually a very good way to read. After the assassination attempt, Achashverosh elevated Haman, this nobody, and put him into a position of authority. That will be one read. The other read is, the Gemara in Megillah, a classic, Yud Gimel Amud Beis, says, Achar ha-devarim ha'ela, after these things, after the refuah was in place, after the cure for the problem is in place, because Esther is now in power, and Mordechai has saved Achashverosh, now comes the dangerous element, the elevation of Haman entirely out of the blue. That's going to create the risk for the Jews, but only once the cure is in place. That's Achar ha-devarim ha'ela. After everything is in place, now this elevation out of nowhere. There's more to say, obviously, and we'll talk about track number two, which is that Haman is already a member of the court, God willing, tomorrow.